Hey everybody, it's Jade with another episode of Still Here, Still Healing. This podcast is part of the Saskatchewan Podcast Network. Make sure to check them out if you're interested in hearing more stories based out of Saskatchewan. So, I know I haven't put anything new out lately. I've taken a bit of a break from podcasting over the last 6 months. I've just had a lot of personal things going on in my life, and I really wasn't finding the joy of podcasting and editing and recording and doing all the things. So, took a bit of a break, but I'm back. Very excited to be back. And excited for the future of Still Here, Still Healing and my future in podcasting. I have a couple new things on the go that I can't share with you just yet, but make sure to stay updated on my social media. You can follow me on my personal account on Instagram, which is Jader with 3 R's 94. Or you can follow the podcast's Instagram, which is stillhere.stillhealing.podcast. But enough about me. This is season 2, episode 10, which is the last episode of this season. And I'm going to be discussing the 60s scoop. And for those of you that don't know what that is, I just wanted to give a little bit of context before getting into the episode. So on my Instagram account, I actually made an informative post a while back just explaining what the 60s scoop was. And here is an excerpt from that. The 60s scoop was the mass removal of Indigenous children from their homes into the child welfare system and adoption into white families. This most often happened without consent and was used as a form of assimilation. The overrepresentation of Indigenous children in care accelerated in the 1960s and still continues today. More than 20,000 First Nation, Métis, and Inuit children were taken from their families during the 60s scoop. Some children stayed in Canada, while others were adopted to families in the United States and even as far as New Zealand. Survivors are impacted in many different ways. Some examples could be feeling a loss of identity, disconnection from family and territory, loss of culture, language, and traditions, confusion and lack of sense of belonging, feeling of loneliness and isolation, and some survivors also report sexual and physical abuse. On this episode, we're going to hear from Elaine, who is a 60s scoop survivor. She's going to share her story with us, which I'm so grateful that she took the time to do so and come on the podcast. So I hope you guys enjoy it. Take a listen.
Not all of us always talk about our experiences.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Because we're talking about such an emotional engagement and disattachment and attachment and trauma,
mm-hmm.
depending on where we were or where we were at or where we went. Or if they told us anything or didn't tell us anything, like there's even trauma of being told or not told. Either way, there's a trauma,
mm-hmm.
and disengagement of language. And when we went to residential schools, we could see each other. And sometimes that was a comfort, but there was still a disattachment.
Mm-hmm.
Language, community, family, territory. But you had the comfort to fall back as your students, co-students could carry you.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When we were taken in child welfare, there was such an isolation. It was the same, similar, but there was such a loss because
mm-hmm.
we were so isolated and we were sent everywhere. Like I know survivors sent to New Zealand, Australia, France, Germany, like there was such isolation.
Yeah.
Cree people, Odawa, Ojibwe, Algonquin, like we were sent everywhere. And in there is that isolation of to be English. to speak English, to dress English, to, and some of us weren't even told our nation.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I started getting the conversation, like I was contacted by Saskatchewan Social Services. Your mother's put in, your biological mother's put in this reunification. And it scared me because those are the places where I was beginning to meet her, beginning to meet my mom,
mm-hmm.
in 92. And even then it was like, I didn't do anything in 92, 93. I didn't go home till 96. And even that wait time may be used against you.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you make her wait? And that's siblings and family saying she already sacrificed a lot. And when they told my mom, you know, when they apprehended us as kids, the worker even outright said to her, you don't look for your kids. We sent them down to the state so you won't find them. Like, imagine being told that.
Mm-hmm. Just threatening.
Going like... to your parenting brain. Like, I was just like, that's such a cruel to not know. So when we speak of missing and murdered, like, we were missing. But it was legality of state, of child welfare, of Indian agent, of the church, of RCMP, because they were all a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
So when I speak of missing and murdered, I think to my mom, because she was told different things, and that worker never talked to her again after. And she didn't even have the proper... because my mom only spoke Cree.
Mm-hmm.
So, and she didn't read. So anything that was sent to her or signed, she couldn't read it. She couldn't even write it. So she, like, those human rights violations of back then were all over this country. So, Bajou Ani Tansi Kwekwe Wache Sego, Elaine Dijnakaz. My name is Elaine. Maingan Dodam, which I'm Wolf Clan. Pelican Narrows Donjaba. I'm status in Pelican. Peter Ballantyne Cree Nation. And I was born at a time of grief. I was just born at the time of grief of, I was born at, I would be in residential school from Prince Albert Indian Residential School, like my siblings. Or I was born at the time of the height of AIM, and I was apprehended in 1969 from my dirt road in Dinair Beach. And I'm sibling of 13, but I'm Jean LaLiberty's, or Jean McDermott, youngest daughter, known as Baby Jean. And I have the picture of my catalog picture. That's what they put us in, catalogs. And I met my mom in 96 when I went home. I made the choice to go home. A lot of us, sometimes we aged out of care, or we ran away from our adopted homes, or ran away from our group homes or our foster care homes. I made a choice to leave my adopted home. I wasn't in a good way though when I left. I left that home when I was 17. And I'm labeled as a 60 scoop survivor. So that's that place of the different childhood labels we get, you know, like shy, doesn't speak up, has an issue with authority, doesn't like being told what to do. And when I met my mom, she always said, you must be mad. And I said, no, I just want to spend time with you. And that's the day I met her, with my older sister. And I'm very grateful I went home, because I didn't know all of me of who I was going home to. I had been struggling with addictions and, you know, inconsistencies in my life, whether it was a relationship, a job, or, you know, like, where am I going? Who am I? What will happen if I become a parent? Do I want to be a parent? How will I teach my children about how to be Cree? Like, how do you even be Cree? Like, and I call it my white family. My white family couldn't tell me that. So then you have to go to a bridge in the road to say, I have to do it. I have to own my stuff and take myself home. And so I did. And from there, I met, you know, the first seven of my family. There's two different families. And then I met my younger siblings. And the first family, that in my mom's family, a lot of us were raised out, either raised by my grandparents or raised in day school or raised in residential school, but also raised in care, her first group of children. And the second group of her children, I have five younger brothers. They were all raised in day school and residential school. The majority of them were raised in Prince Albert Indian Residential School. So that's why I always say I was raised at the time that we were childless communities. Mm-hmm. There was no children. And if we went to the day schools near the schools, that you still felt a loss, because we weren't always raised with our siblings. And that's a direct disconnect. You know, we only connect through the parent, but sometimes there's a disconnect of these siblings. So sometimes even today, you'll have siblings that don't talk to each other because they don't know each other. There's been no memory of building your life. So I'm very grateful I've rebuilt some of those memories instead of just a trauma bond. Mm-hmm. Mom would cry about you. Mom was sad when your birthday came up, or Christmas, or, you know, Easter, like different things like that. There was always a sense of deep sadness. It wasn't just with one child. It was with many of her children. And there's a deep sadness in the community, not just from one child. That was the thing. Mm-hmm. It was the many children. So, and the impact still is affected and felt today, even all the way to my grandchildren. Mm-hmm. Still affected today. And I know that, you know, that's that place of, you didn't live through that experience, but you still carry the sadness. And you sometimes you don't know why there's sadness. And so that in itself is that intergenerational sadness that gets placed through our bloodline, through our umbilical cord, through our creation story. Even through our creation story, there's such sadness. But I always tell my son and my grandchildren, you're born at the time of knowing a truth place, but to know that we can change how we talk about it. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a trauma attachment, but there's a resiliency. Like, they didn't take all the language, they didn't take all the song, they didn't take all the ceremony, they didn't take all of that place of who you are to feel alive. I always, you know, dress in so many colors. I'm alive, I'm living, I'm living proof. We're living proof. We are living proof that we're strong, that we're loved, that we're incredible, that we are. People get astonished, like, oh, you can do that? Damn right, we're not outlawed no more. I can go wherever I want, anywhere in the world.
Yeah. I wanted to just say thank you for validating that, you know, the intergenerational survivors, because Like in this past season on my podcast, I talked to quite a few intergenerational survivors, and like I am one myself. And so I think sometimes we carry a little bit of guilt of like, you know, we didn't have to go through what our parents and our grandparents went through, but somehow we're still feeling it. And it's like, should I be feeling that? But it's not our fault. Like it was just there. And that's right. I think a lot of people don't understand that. So I just want, I just wanted to say thank you for validating that and mentioning that.
Yeah. Partly it's that teaching of what my grandchildren and our children teach us to, like they carry this space of loss that is to still be honored. Like, I don't know that, or I didn't know that, or the shock when we actually disclose or divulge what happened. And they were like, I didn't know, like, and anxiety comes from that too. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, you know, it's okay to feel those feelings because it's absolutely shocking. You're right. When you hear that, like we were talking with my brother, when we went home, I was really grateful. I went to, we were brought to the PAW, and from the PAW, I said, if we stay a couple of days, because the college university brought us in to do a talking and speaking. And I was really grateful that they said, you can stay for a couple more days. And I was like, for sure, because I'd like to like not leave right away. Because my brother lives in Cumberland House and my sister lives in the back home in Demare still. And I'd like to pay respects to my granny and grandpa at the and my mom at the funeral gravesite, you know, just go pay our respects, right? Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. So that was a great. So I was really grateful we were able to come home before pandemic hit. And even in that was validating, you know, like, how are you related? Who are you related? This is what we would eat. This is what we, you know, and all this came flooding back into me. And that, I believe, is like, we're eating back our own culture. We're hearing back our own culture. We're feeling our own culture. We're placing ourselves in there. Mm-hmm. And I always remind my son, you know, like, even in when I go home, like, I'm still a tourist even when I go home.
Yeah, what does that feel like for you? Like, I guess you're reconnecting, but it's all like it's almost like you probably would feel like an outsider, or like what's that feeling for you when you came home?
When I came home, it was definitely like a tourist. I was still, as I shared, like I was still struggling with addictions. Mm-hmm. So there was still that attachment of where do I belong? And then I had a, you know, kind of like a mini intervention with my older siblings, because they said, you know, like they were pretty up front, like they're, as I hear my older sister, we're like, we don't mess around, we'll tell you like it is, right? And they came right out, like, what kind of drinker are you? Are you a binge drinker, or are you this kind of drinker? And then as I'm going through the years talking about this with my siblings, they were like, no, we were never like sip and drink. Like we're like straight on, drink the whole case kind of. And all my siblings were like that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that time is that place of even identifying that addiction process in our family is a big one. Mm-hmm. And that place of where they wrote about my mom and they lied. They said she was an alcoholic, and my mom, she had drinks, but she was never one. It was in my previous generations of my grandparents that were heavy, heavy drinkers. And that's hard, because that's that ownership of how much alcohol has been in our family structure. Mm-hmm. Addiction, violence, loss, apprehension, residential school, Indian hospitals, because my mom was a TB sanatorium survivor too. Mm. That's the other part.
Yeah.
But for myself, when I went home, I definitely felt like a tourist, but it also validated, like, people look like me. People have my eyes. People have my own laugh. Like, suddenly I could hear me. Suddenly I wasn't like the what's that story? Like the duckling that gets adopted by the ugly duckling that mm-hmm. gets adopted by like a goose family or something, right? Like I could hear me, and it reaffirmed of course I'm like this. That makes so much sense. And like, I was apprehended at a time when all my language, like not all my language, but my language development, I only spoke Cree. So while I was in care, I lost my language. Mm-hmm. So I still think in my language, but because of how they treated us and my body still shakes when I speak, I can sing my language back to me. So the way I'm doing it is I'm singing my language back to me because the physical feel still, and that's that treatment of how we were treated as little people to squeeze the life out of you if you spoke your language. Mm-hmm. And so my body still gets a reaction. But I challenge myself and I do try to go to language classes, but then I have to deal with my own post-traumatic because they're eager kids that are learning so many conversational languages. So when I'm home, it's always like a big crash course between my siblings and my relations. And I'm very grateful. I just got a new CD of children's language class. So it's again being sung back into me. Mm-hmm. And I can hear it and I can understand, but I cannot speak. There's still a block there. And I'm in my 50s and I still have blocks from childhood.
Yeah, I've heard that too from other survivors, residential school survivors saying that too. It's like our body is telling us like,
yeah,
our body just like knows so much. And like even before like our mind does. And so, yeah, I've heard other survivors saying like they'll try to speak it, but there's just a block there. And
And it's not a fault. It's just, you know, hearing our children speak, like my son's a Pawa singer and dancer. And you know, I said, we can only take you so far because of the different places of where your dad was raised. He was raised in Indian hospitals. He was raised in day school. He was raised out too when he was taken into care. And the time of the language, it was outlawed in this country. Mm-hmm. Like we have to acknowledge that, you know, so we're only in the first 50 years of bringing back our language. And now there's like these different programs to fund for us to get our language back. Here they outlawed, they policied our language to the place where they would like, it's no longer relevant. Mm-hmm. But language, when I hear it and I sing it and when I sing it and when people are saying it and I'm doing from childhood language to adult language to speaking it, I'm still doing the different effects of how I and I always say how I understand that word or how it's being spoken means this to me. So I understand the Ojibwe, the Algonquin, and the Cree. Mm. You know. And that I'm very grateful for because I have a really, I think, a very strong basis of my language.
Yeah, for sure. And there's like similarities between the languages too. So
Yeah.
So when you were taken from home, were you taken right to Ontario or what was that journey like for you?
Yeah. Well, I went to, like, according to my paperwork, I went to 4 homes, but according to my mom, my biological mom, I went to 5. So like I was apprehended from Denair. I was put in a home close to where my mom lived and my mom came to her house and took me. And so the next time they apprehended me, I was taken down to Prince Albert.
Okay.
So that's further away from Denair. That's good 3 hours. And then from Denair, from Denair to Prince Albert, I went to Yorkton, they said. And I was put on a farm down there. And then from Yorkton, I went back to Prince Albert. And then I was adopted and sent to Saskatoon. So as a little person, in less in a, and I was only in care for a year and a half. So it seemed like every 2 months I was like, you know, like, I would have a bag packed.
A big change today. Once in a while, you're just changing. Yeah. Gosh.
Like I still have a bag packed every, like I don't unpack certain bags.
And how old were you at that time?
I was apprehended when I was almost 3. And I was adopted when I was almost 4.
Okay.
So old enough to remember.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And trauma in children, they remember trauma as opposed to blankets, shoes, food.
Mm-hmm.
But I always said, I don't remember them feeding us and I don't remember a bed. You know, like, like that's messed up. Mm-hmm. I remember the bed in my adopted home when I got there, you know, because I was adopted by a Ukrainian lady and a British man.
So you would have been, sorry, you were in Saskatoon and then adopted from there?
No, they went up to Prince Albert and they brought me down to Saskatoon.
Oh, okay.
So I was adopted. Because they did all the court paperwork in Saskatoon, at the Saskatoon, I'm just looking at the paperwork again, out of the Saskatoon courthouse.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. 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 So, and that's that place of, who was I adopted to? I was adopted to, and there's even survivor guilt of who we've been adopted by, right?
Yeah.
Like I was adopted by a pretty open family that didn't totally know, because, you know, like we have to acknowledge these families did not know that they were adopting in a time of genocide.
Mm-hmm.
There's that place of, we just thought we were adopting a child.
Yeah.
And they had these TV commercials. They had TV commercials. And my, you know, and I don't mean to put my adopted mom down, you know, like when, like there's still that loyalty.
Mm-hmm.
The way she explained it to me was there was just so many of us. And that was what they had always wanted, to adopt a child from their children. And they knew that the last one would be adopted. And then the news media, the TV, the radio, they were giving this impression that there was a lot of Indigenous children that needed safe homes.
Mm-hmm.
So they pulled on those structural heartstrings of normal interaction of, oh, children need help, let's go. But and so they were pushing the AIM adoption process. Adopt an Indian and Métis children. There's many children that need your help.
Mm-hmm.
So my nice Ukrainian mom was like, there was just so many of you. And I imagine probably when she went to the home and she was looking through the catalog book, there would probably be a lot. You're right. But, you know, they even carry guilt too. You know, they don't carry guilt that they loved me and that they adopted me, but they carry the guilt that they weren't told all of it. Like as people that were, and they still are, like human rights and raising and helping. And like I was raised also in Africa, because they worked for a third world agency. So how else would a Cree end up in Africa?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when I told my biological mom, oh yeah, I was raised partly in Africa. My mom was like, I didn't tell them to take you there, right? Because she still would see the worker every now and again who had said, we sent her to the United States, so you stop looking.
Mm.
But my mom would say, I hope it's a good Catholic family. Right? And she was even told, I was raised by a Catholic family. Like these little tidbits would get back to her.
Yeah.
None of them true.
Yeah.
None of them.
Just like a whole lot of scheming, it seems ugh.
So as a parent that's devastated, that may be dealing with growing into mental health. That's the difficulty that I grow up with, of when I'm finding my truth within my family, where, and I'm so loyal to my mom that I don't want to hurt. But some of the mothers ended up in psych ward, the psychiatric ward. Mm-hmm. And they still weren't being treated well in the psychiatric. And you wonder why we have such mistrust for medical, you know, because the way they treat us, and they still treat us, that's still being outed, you know. Yeah. I know she was a very quiet, loving mother that loved us so much. And I'm so grateful that, you know, like this is the wild thing, like, couple of years later, I'd been home and met all my family and stuff like that. I was sitting in the middle of a powwow, like in Mi'kmaq territory out in northern Quebec. And I was like, I got to call my mom. Like, I have to call my mom, like, right now. And so I did, right? Like, I just kind of went to a quiet spot and I called her. And they told me to call this other number. And so I did. And she only spoke Cree to me. And she, like, I would say, Mom, remember, I don't speak anymore. And she only spoke Cree to me. And I was like, something's going on. Like, what's going on? So I called my other brother, my younger brother. And they were like, we were going to tell you. We were going to call you. It's her time. She's getting ready to go. And I was like, oh, my God. Right? Like, I couldn't believe the strong, through our years of disconnect, we were so connected all the way to the end of her days. Mm-hmm. And I, that to me is a huge gift. And, you know, if you ever have those moments where you know, you don't believe that there's a connection and you get validated, hold on to that validation. Mm-hmm. You've always belonged and you've always been loved. And your land and your people and your songs have always called you. And those little moments validate this place of I belong here. And I was really grateful because she passed away about 2 weeks later. And I still am amazed by those moments. You know, I got that when certain other things have happened in my life and I was like, I'm on this right path. Mm-hmm. Some people call it deja vu, but some, you know, like I didn't know, but that umbilical cord and the stars aligned and to listen to those gut feelings of I have to do this now.
Yeah.
You know, and I was really grateful because she was speaking the language of love to me. And that I can still hear to this day. Mm-hmm. And I'm so grateful because, you know, I never met my dad. You know, I didn't see him till this year, actually last year, like before COVID. There's still a shyness and hesitancy, right? Like, can I do that? And you never know. And so I was talking to my older sister and I said, you know, I never seen a picture of my dad. And she's like, what? How come? You know, because we have a lot of different dads in our family. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I don't know. I never asked. She goes, well, go ask, you know, social media, send her a Facebook message because I'm friends with my dad's sister. Mm. And I was like, I don't know. Like I got all like that anxiousness. Like, can I do that? Is that allowed? Am I allowed to know more of my story, where I come from? And that old feeling of I just leave it alone, like even that old feeling came back. And she's my sister's so intuitive to me. And she's like, what's the matter? I said, I don't know if I can. And she goes, give me the phone. She took my phone and she sent the message. And I was really grateful because that's that place of, you know, like, how would I ask? Like, how do I say that? Like, I want to know, but I don't know even how to. No.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I got a picture and then I showed it. And then I finally, you know, like the power of Instagram and layouts, and I was able to put the three of us together. My mom, me in the middle, and my dad.
Nice.
And that was cool because I was like, wow, that's who I look like.
Yeah.
Where I'm from.
Oh, that's so nice.
You know, but I still don't know very much about my dad's side. You know, he's from Île aux Cras, or he's from Buffalo.
Oh, okay. Yeah, on the west side.
Yeah. And my mom's from Pelican or Denair. So, and they both met at the sanatorium.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So those are the different places where, you know, hopefully one day, I mean, when the weather is right, I'll come back and do these journeys about finding all of me.
Throughout the episode so far, you've probably heard mention of AIM, and you've also probably heard Elaine talk about TV advertisements. I wanted to give a little bit of background to this. So in Saskatchewan in 1967, there was a program called AIM, which stands for Adopt Indian and Métis. It was implemented by the Saskatchewan government, and the program used advertising in newspapers, TV, and radio to sell children to prospective adoptive parents.
Have you ever considered adopting a child? Many couples have found their happiness through AIM. AIM is a division of the Department of Welfare, established as a placement service for Indian and Métis children. AIM, 2340 Albert Regina. All inquiries handled promptly and in confidence.
Staff from AIM were even awarded Salesperson of the Year in recognition of the number of children made wards of the province. It's also important to note that at the time, in the media, the way that Indigenous children and Indigenous families were spoken about was very negative, and implied that Indigenous children were unwanted and that parents could not or were unfit to parent their own children.
Kilburn Hall in Saskatoon, one of the many reception centers throughout Saskatchewan for unwanted Indian and Métis children. They are the products of a sudden and sharp rise in illegitimate births and marriage breakdowns among Indian and Métis people. Until 12 months ago, they were becoming wards of the government at a rate of almost 200 a year, and adoption agencies were finding them almost impossible to find permanent homes for.
It was a program out of Saskatchewan that started in 1967. It was a program specifically to apprehend Indigenous children, because there was still that whole attitude that we could not raise our children. And it was under the child welfare. So it started because they would put us in newspapers like puppies, mm-hmm. right? Like, adopt this child. She's a little chubby, but you know, like she's talkable, and she gets along well with others. And you know, like there's like they actually have documentation, like at the AIM programs of the workers, like they were the salesperson of the year of how many kids they adopted. Like, imagine, like, salesperson.
Yeah. It's just like, it's another form. It's like a form of human trafficking is really like.
That's what it is.
Yeah.
Today, you call it human trafficking. But back then, it was like, oh, it's part of that Indian problem again.
Oh, my goodness.
Right? Because it's part of this place called the Indian problem. Mm-hmm. And that in itself was part of land and resource extraction. So we, as the Indigenous children, were the resource. to make sure that the problem didn't exist in the future. Now, do they say it that way? No. But the reality is those are the places where the, and now it's just called like the tragic chapter, right? Well, you know what? The tragedy is still existing because it's still in our families today. And this is where they didn't number us. I always have to say that. They didn't number how many of us. So each province does not have a number of how many children were apprehended, documented, or where they were sent. Mm-hmm. And some of the families that they had set up were not even police record checked. So these children were part of the sex trade.
Mm-hmm. I'm also curious, to know like how many people are still out there that don't even know that they were adopted. Do you think that's a thing?
Yes. Yes.
That they're just out there living their lives and they would have no clue that they were an Indigenous person or were adopted at a young age.
There's a classic one from Germany where a parent passed away and they got a box of all the goods and in there was his adoption record. You know, that's that larger place of knowing that that they, you know, like Patrick Stewart was the one that termed the 60s scoop, right? In the 80s. And now it's called the baby scoop era, you know, like from the 1950s for the white, you know, and I don't mean to offend when I say white, right? But it was like the baby scoop era, you know, but ours was termed in the 80s. So for 20 years, we weren't even, we were just like kids in child welfare, that's it, you know? Mm-hmm. But actually what they were physically doing was, mine is a classic, the dark car came up the road and they were grabbing us. Like they didn't even get out of the car. They were like physically just picking us up and throwing us in the back seat of a dark car. And I was just like, who does that? Who gets paid to physically kidnap kids? Mm-hmm. and then be called salesman of the year?
Wow.
And that's that place of, you know, us as children still can stand under state law and charge people for any abuse because it was done in childhood. So when I called the CAS in Saskatchewan, I said, I want the names of the foster homes because I was abused in each and every one. Mm-hmm. And I want their names, even if they're dead. I want to at least know the names of the people that abused me. But because of the system of back then, everything's blocked out.
Yeah.
That's the crap part of different parts of our memory will never be validated. And that in itself is exactly like you said, we're walking around. We don't even know. But we feel a piece of us that's gone. Something's missing. What is it? Nobody's telling me. It's not written anywhere. Some people don't even know their nation, right? Like I was very grateful when I got my Indian card. Like I'd always known I was born in Flin Flon. Every northern girl is born in Flin Flon, right? But when I got this piece of identity that I'm an Indian, I finally found out I'm from Peter Ballantyne Cree Nation. I never knew that before. Mm-hmm. I never knew that until I was 27.
That was another thing that like when we first started following each other on Instagram, I was like, oh my God, why do I know? I feel like I know this lady. Like I have no idea who she is. We've never met before. But for some reason, I felt like I knew you or I recognized you. And I'm like, is this just like a northern thing that we like have this connection somehow? Yeah. So
we find each other.
Yeah.
We find each other. I just was speaking with another northern person that just moved over here like 3 years ago, but I found her through some essential oils that are from up in James Bay Cree. And I was like, oh, okay, you know, like that's that place of how far our people have gone. All the way to James Bay Cree, to all the way, because Swampy Cree is, we're everywhere, mm-hmm. right? Same like Chippewa, and same like Ojibwe, and same like Algonquin. Like we are all intermingled and all were interrelated.
Mm-hmm.
But that place of tragedy is in each and every one of us, as individual, family, territory, community. Mm-hmm. But what do we do with it, right? And I guess, you know, Murray Sinclair can, you know, say it really well of, you know, what do we do with it? We acknowledge it. We acknowledge to never do it again. And we acknowledge how it still is in our life today.
Mm-hmm. How do you, we've heard the term that like it's still happening in our child mm-hmm. welfare systems. We see the overrepresentation. Yeah. And Murray Sinclair has touched on this as well. Like, what are your thoughts on that?
Mine is automatically stop taking our kids. You got to stop this process of thinking that we're not good enough. You know, the reality is you have to try better to stand with us. Because as soon as the child agency comes in, that big flood of anger, and that's an intergenerational anger now, and it's not just anger, it's rage.
Mm-hmm.
Stop taking our kids. How do we do this better when, like, if I was struggling and you and I were living in the same community and you saw me as a grandmother or an auntie or a young mom, whatever age I was at, and I was struggling, we talked to each other as community. Hey, what's going on? Did you feed your kids today? You know, you didn't pick up the phone, or you didn't answer the door, mm-hmm. or your house is a mess. You know, like, let's have this large conversation. You're right. In addictions and chaos, it's messy. What we've lived through is really messy. So how do we comfort each other by saying, you're right, in neglect. It's still messy. So let's acknowledge there's neglect happening. Let's even just stay in that for a moment. And with neglect comes that place of knowing there's still love for yourself and your children. So then you separate the neglect. So there's love for you and your children. And the neglect doesn't need to overcome that.
Mm-hmm.
So who else in the love for you and your children would come and help right now? And that in itself is specialized listening and specialized learning. So it doesn't always go back to the same old, same old.
Mm-hmm.
And so we get angry when we get called out too. But it's also calling in. I'm calling you in because I love you so much that I see there's hurt. So let's try and navigate. And it doesn't mean that you have to leave, because that's also that place of when we get called out, our automatic is to run away.
Mm-hmm.
You don't have to leave. But let's try and navigate this call back and forth so that you call me out too. Maybe I could have said it better. Maybe I reminded you of, like, when I go home, I remind everybody of my mom. You know, I don't mean to trigger people just by the way I look,
mm-hmm.
or my tone, or how I said it, or if I said it with fancy words. I don't mean to make anyone sound demeaning, but it's really having that specialized delivery and reciprocal to engage in really difficult problem solving, but also getting each other's feeling related to how do we make sure that this stops? And there's no easy answer. There's never going to be an easy answer. So people want an easy answer, but this is never going to be an easy answer. And we can't ignore it either, because mm-hmm. it's still happening. You know, at the height of, you know, that's the thing. At the height of residential school, the same amount of kids in care. Okay, so what will we as the people do about that? Because there are kids. Mm. It's really important for us to have a sense of we're in control of our lives. We can go anywhere. That's that place of we're no longer outlawed. We can speak our language. We can show who we are, you know, at every given moment of every part of the day. Because that's how we were always meant to be. Alive and loved and honored.